Take a peek behind the curtains and you'll find that recording a podcast conversation is a fascinating and somewhat unique experience. In that moment, the guest and host are speaking privately, sharing their thoughts and stories just with each other. Yet, they do so knowing that their words will later reach thousands of listeners, each experiencing the conversation in their own way, shaped by their own perspectives and reflections. At Insight Myanmar Podcast, we try to conjure up the image of our listeners as though you are seated here with us, a third chair at the table, so to speak, which helps us create the feel of a more intimate conversational experience. So, as you listen, we hope that you can lean into this connection and join us in exploring these stories and discover where they may take you. Welcome to the conversation. We're glad you're here.
Everyone, welcome back to the Insight Myanmar podcast. For this episode, we are joined by Mohammed Siraj, a Rohingya multidisciplinary researcher, political analyst, and human rights advocate currently living in Gundarbalong refugee camp in Bangladesh. Mohammed is the director of research at the Rohingya Academic Research Institute, where he leads research programs, supervises teams, and works to strengthen ethical, community-led knowledge production. Alongside this, he has years of experience teaching secondary education in humanitarian settings and is currently pursuing a degree in health science with aspirations toward law and legal scholarship. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me today. It is an honor for me to have give an interview at the Inside Myanmar podcast. Thank you.
Before we talk about your work or research, I want to start with how you position yourself. When you introduce yourself, which identity feels most central to you? Researcher, educator, advocate, Rohingya, or something else?
Yeah, to introduce myself, I feel the most, central thing is I am a Rohingya and I am a researcher and aspiring legal scholar.
Great. How do you navigate the tension between being seen primarily as a refugee and being a scholar and political analyst?
Yeah, actually, I'm an aspiring legal scholar. In the future, I would like to participate in Myanmar government, like in parliament, whether or judicial institutions or executive institutions. It is my biggest dream. So I would like to pursue my postgraduate study with, a law major. Because, in Myanmar, the Myanmar government has systematically denied our political rights, our, indigenous status. So to restore our citizenship, our political rights, and fair political participation, I need to study law. I want to work towards recognition of the Rohingya identity as an indigenous ethnic community and restoring the citizenship rights and reforming the Myanmar constitutions and have a fair, meaningful representation of marginalized groups, including the Rohingya, within executive, legislative, and judicial institution. So actually, before I used to, dream to become a doctor, but after, realizing something, my dream has, changed. As the, time changes, the mind also changes. So, transition from, aspiring doctor to aspiring legal scholar is not a rejection of science. It is, also an expression of responsibility and understanding the world more, deeply. So I see law as a powerful instrument for systemic transformation in Myanmar.
I agree with you. In situations like ours, we need to look beyond these constraints and tensions in order to create space for peace, democracy, and freedom for everyone. So my next question is, your academic and professional journey spans political science, public administration, and health sciences. So what drew you to research and analysis in the first place?
Yeah, actually, in refugee settings, academic line is very, limited. For example, when I was in Myanmar, I completed GRACES classes in Myanmar and, I started my class 7. At that time, the Kalyan's genocidal operations, was launched. So due to that, military operations, we had to flee into Bangladesh. After coming in Bangladesh, I managed to complete my high schools in academic year 2020-2023. At the same time, I used to volunteer, as a training assistant at the Rohingya Graduation for Women Institution, where I used to, teach political science and public administration to the university level Rohingya student. Since I'm a high school student, and then after graduating my high school, I also joined the Rohingya Academic Research Institute, where I completed 2 years, 2.5 years diploma in academic research studies. After graduating from that, I volunteered there as the director of research. And I also, lead youth researchers and teach them how to conduct research, how to write, research papers systematically. So, and I also work at different, organizations, including, in Latin Myanmar Research Foundations, also known as NAIN Corridors. I also work there as a community researcher for more than 1 year, covering up in Myanmar, local level institutions and governance, comparative analysis between the, post-military coup and the, military, government, administration, and also, nationwide humanitarian assessment. I also participated with the Myanmar research team. So my main central, future focus is the law and politics, pursuing advanced legal education to contribute to the international legal scholarship with a meaningful, constitutional and institutional, reform processes, democratic governance, especially in Myanmar. So I want to, help to dismantle the legal structure that enable exclusions and violence. And I want to, replace them with a framework grounded in equality, accountability, and justice. So actually, as a, Rohingya, the Myanmar denied our citizenship. So I grew up as a stateless. Growing up as a stateless is, one of the biggest challenge I have ever faced. Because when I applied to the university, even if I, got the acceptance offers, then I don't have the, travel document like passport to go to the university. So without, a travel document, the university, do not allow me to pursue the education. So ultimately, I finally found an option to study online at the University of the People.
Well, I can imagine that must have been a huge struggle. When you didn't have a passport or official identity documents, how did that affect your ability to apply to universities? Were there any universities you had hoped to join?
Actually, my dream is very big. Like, I want to study, after graduating from the University of the People, I would like to, study at the University of Cambridge to study, Master of Law in International Law. And also, I'm interested to study at the Oxford University. But as a refugee, I'm not sure whether it is possible for me or not, but I am, determined and hopeful.
I would say it's really important to hold on to those dreams and hope for a better future. I really admire the ambition behind the work you've been doing. In many places, especially for young people in developing countries, volunteering often becomes the first step toward discovering what they want to do in the future. That journey from doing community work to eventually engaging in research and analysis is really fascinating. I have actually never been to Bangladesh, but I've always been curious about how research is conducted there. For example, one studying issues like law, education, or public health, what kinds of resources are available for researchers? And particularly for someone coming from a refugee background, how do you even begin discovering and documenting these issues? Actually, to be honest, I didn't often have the opportunity to meet or speak directly with people from marginalized or displaced communities. Sometimes it's not easy to have those conversations. We really need spaces where people can sit down, share ideas, and discuss the challenges communities are facing. So thank you for sharing your experiences with us.
Yeah, actually, the Rohingya Academic Research Institute was, established in 2022. With the, dream of, making and building Rohingya researchers to write their own history, their own, voice, writing their own, voice, their own, fighting for their rights. So when it was established, then, I joined with the, I contact with the, founder. And then he joined me there. After that, I joined there as a student. I also, volunteered as a, research facilitator at that time. Then I become a, research team coordinator. Then I become as the director of research. And finally, it has, introduced another program like associate degree in political science. I'm going to also lead this, program. So, Rohingya Academic Research Institute was, is one of the, historic institutes in the Rohingya community, because it has also received the 2025, Global Excellent Education Awards in Community Leadership and Community Development. So, the programs Rohingya Academic Research Institute offer are very effective. They also offer, some short courses. Especially, it has two main programs. One is the academic research program. Another one is the political science program. So it is very effective for the Rohingya youth who have no opportunity to study higher education. So the institution is building young Rohingya to be a part in different kinds of field to make them well informed and aware generation. So it says, more than 20 professors from different universities, they are also volunteering. Everyone in the Rohingya Academic Research Institute is volunteering, including the founder, because there is no funding and any kinds of resources.
I see. Nowadays, issues around intellectual property and funding can be quite challenging for many organizations.
Yeah.
In that context, how important do you think methodological rigor is in research? And why is it especially important when the research focuses on marginalized or displaced communities?
Yeah, actually, research means, you have to maintain the ethical standard, whatever it is, whether it is human research, whether it is social research, whether it is, ethnographic research, whatever it is, we must have to maintain the ethical standard first. The methodology that comes depend on the context of the research, whether you are a research person, whether your objective, needs both, mismatch like qualitative and quantitative, whether it's only need the, ethnographic research method or it's need, like both quantitative and qualitative. It depend on the research question and context. So according to me, I also, follow both methods, like sometimes a qualitative method based on the research context, sometimes quantitative, sometimes mixed method. So it's, depend on the research objectives, on the context of the research. Yeah.
Okay. Now I'd like to move on to the topic of teaching diversity and leadership. As you've conducted extensive research and spent several years working with educational organizations such as Plan International, CODEC, and UNICEF. From your experience as a researcher and director of research, what have you learned about the intellectual potential of Rohingya youth? And how do you approach mentoring and building diversity within the teams you work with as director of research? How do you approach mentoring and capacity building within your team?
Yeah, actually, teaching was also one of the moral responsibility for me. By the time I have been teaching since I was a grade 8 student. When I'm studying grade 8, I also teach the grade 8 student. When I'm studying class 9, I also teach the class 10 student. So it was both my responsibility, and it is also beneficial for me to strengthen my academic foundation. So I was very passionate also in teaching, because it allowed me to also improve my academic backgrounds, and also help me to understand the subject more deeply. So in refugee settings, all the students are traumatized. So before teaching, I have to listen their perspective deeply and understand their situation. So based on the student situation, I need to develop the lesson plan. I need to teach them based on their focus, based on their interest. So it is very important to see first the student reaction, and according to the student reaction, then I need to deliver the lesson. I used to teach like that. So in Plan International Bangladesh, I used to mentor youth. And in Kudek UNHCR, I used to teach science and mathematics to middle school students. In Friendship UNICEF, I used to teach middle and high school students, both math, science, and English. So in refugee camps, educational opportunities are very limited. There are no formal education systems still. So the NGO, learning humanitarian settings are like they are, doing business rather than, delivering the actual education, because they focus on the, organizational documentation rather than, teaching the children. They do not hire the, qualified teachers. They hire whatever they found with the, very low, salary. So it is like a business, not delivering the actual education. Students are getting some kinds of quality education from the community-based high schools. In refugee camps, you know, after coming from Myanmar to Bangladesh, some teachers realized that if we do not, you know, establish summer schools, our student future will be ruined. So, you know, they, you know, established for the first time 32 schools in refugee camps with the Myanmar official curriculum. And, you know, and also after seeing their initiative, many teachers in spare from them, then other teachers also started establishing the school. Now, as of now in 2026, there are 185 community-based high school in the Rohingya refugee camp. The schools are established by the Rohingya community and led by the Rohingya community and teach by the Rohingya community with the Myanmar official curriculum. So those community-based high schools are the hopes and foundation of the Rohingya children. Actually, Rohingya children do not try to go to the, you know, NGO school because there is no actual learnings. They are just digesting the, you know, the humanitarian fund. Because as I teach, you know, in humanitarian settings, I observe and understand everything. I have to, you know, tell the truth, whatever it is.
I see. When it comes to the Myanmar curriculum, how do you manage and run the program overall? And I'm also curious about the language of instruction. What is the main language used when teaching the students?
Yeah, actually, you know, the teacher also studied in Myanmar, so they have the experiences. There are, you know, many government teachers who guide the, you know, junior teachers. Yeah, the languages, you know, also the Myanmar curriculum, they first teach in, you know, Burmese language and explain in the into the Rohingya language. First, they, you know, make them read a student in Burmese, then, you know, also explain the, you know, concept firstly in Burmese, and then later they also explain, you know, in Rohingya language. So it is better for the student to understand everything clearly.
I see. So most of the programs are delivered in Burmese, and you also provide English language programs as well? So, looking at the current situation, what kinds of courses or programs do you think are most needed right now? Are there particular areas or industries that you believe should be strengthened or prioritized?
Yeah, actually, the main things needs for the community-based schools are accreditation, like recognition by any government or any, you know, accreditation body. Because the students are learning from the community-based schools, but their certificates are not recognized for higher studies. When they graduated from the high schools, when they try to apply for the university, but a university, you know, do not accept their certificates because it is not recognized by any government. So the most important thing is, you know, the schools are you know, recognized. The school have to be recognized and, you know, have, you know, some kinds of, you know, institutional guidance and institutional supervision from any government or from any international education agency. It is the most important thing, as I know, for the Rohingya community-based school.
I'm interested in the educational journeys people take. How do you manage for matriculation exam?
You know, before 2024, there was, you know, individual school examination. But in 2025, some community leaders and some highly qualified teachers, you know, thought and established a, you know, Rohingya refugee examination board, The examination board of Rohingya refugees, is a body that, you know, take examination from all the community-based schools. You know, like, for example, it has some, you know, it's gathered some teachers and leaders, and they are, making the examination papers and invites all the school students, and they take the exam in a very formal way. But the examination board of Rohingya refugees is still not recognized by any government fully. But Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commissioner has, you know, appreciated the initiative, and he said in the future they will try to help them to make it, you know, more standardized.
Okay. I'm curious about what happens after the matriculation exam for students in your community? What opportunities do they have for higher education, and which universities are they able to attend?
Still, there is, you know, no such pathway for the Rohingya student after completing their, you know, matriculation. After completing their matriculation, the student do jobs and some study online. They do not have any kinds of opportunity to study at any traditional university, like within in Bangladesh or, you know, outside of Bangladesh, like any other, you know, foreign countries. The main major challenge are, you know, travel documents and the, you know, matriculation, high school matriculation, you know, certificates, because the certificates are not issued by the Ministry of, you know, any government, by the Ministry of Education from any government. That's why the certificates are not, you know, accepted by the university. So there is no such pathway for the Rohingya high school graduate to study higher education.
Well, what about alternative programs like the GED? Do you offer any GED programs for students who want to continue their education in the future?
No, there are no GED program. Also, there are no, you know, other programs except the community-based high schools and the, you know, the NGO schools. There are, you know, one programs like, you know, Refugee Access Higher Education Program, which is a program offered by the, you know, Open Society University and the Rak University, but it is a, you know, 1.5 years programs for the high school student. They are, you know, very few. They take very few, you know, students. After graduating from those program, they sometimes offer a scholarship to study in Philippines. In last year, you know, the Philippines, you know, took maybe 30 students from Bangladesh after graduating from the Refugee Access Higher Education Program. So it is very limited. I think it is negligible. It cannot be considered as a, you know, broader pathway for the Rohingya refugee to study higher education.
What about language learning? In Myanmar, many young people study foreign languages such as Japanese, Korean, or other international languages because they hope to study or work abroad. However, I understand that for many Rohingya refugee students, access to opportunity like IELTS training or overseas education can be very challenging. In your programs, do students also have opportunities to learn other foreign languages such as Japanese, Korean, Thai, or French, if they are interested?
Actually, you know, the basic, the primary language for the Rohingya students here are like Burmese, Rohingya, and English. These three languages are primary. But if, you know, a Rohingya student get opportunity to study any foreign countries, if the university require to, you know, have the their own, you know, language proficiency, then a student will try to study because he needs, the student need it to study. So if the language is mandatory, then a student will study. But there are no, I think, I don't have any interest. And I am also, you know, thinking other students don't have any kinds of interest to study such, you know, foreign language without, you know, mandatory demand. As a Rohingya, as a Myanmar, you know, population, we'll return in Myanmar one day. So we must need Burmese. So we prioritize Burmese language rather than any other language.
And what about Marma language?
The Marma language, actually, we don't understand. We understand, but we don't learn Marma language. When they speak, we understand their language, but we don't learn about their language.
Could you also tell us about language used in the refugee camps? What languages do people usually speak there? Do they mainly speak Rohingya, Burmese, Bangla, or English?
You know, every Rohingya speak Rohingya language, you know, in their home, in everywhere. Currently Rohingya language have also, you know, a script, written text. You know, most of the, you know, Rohingya also study in the Rohingya language. in schools, in workplace, sometimes they speak Burmese, sometimes English. It is depend on the situation. But the primary, speaking language is the Rohingya language.
We have talked about education and language. So I'd like to move to your research. Your work covers important areas such as genocide, constitutional reform, and human rights violations. How do you balance maintaining academic objectivity while also engaging in advocacy?
Actually, research is a very, very, important thing for the Rohingya community, cover up to, write the hidden history to, raise our voice, to represent our community in a correct way, in a right way. So actually, I conduct, multidisciplinary research because in Rohingya community, there are different, aspect lack of understanding. Like, for example, recently I have written an article about the Rohingya crisis is Myanmar crisis, constitutional and citizenship law as the architecture of genocide. So in this, articles, I discussed the, Rohingya crisis is, inseparable, from the national crisis of Myanmar because Rohingya is also core part of Myanmar and Myanmar is part of Rohingya. Whether the Myanmar government, accept it or reject it, it doesn't matter. This is the truth. So the legal framework is the root causes of the crisis. And to end this prolonged, Rohingya crisis, require fundamentally the constitutional and the citizenship law reform. Without the recognition of indigenous status and equitable political participation, the crisis, will never be solved. So Rohingya crisis cannot be separated from the larger, larger political and social crisis of Myanmar. Rohingya are not outsiders because they are also the integral populations of Myanmar. So, many people think the Rohingya crisis is the humanitarian crisis, but this is not the, humanitarian crisis. It is about the institutional and, political crisis. So I think, and also, different people think it is a, ethnic tensions, rooted in the, ethnic tension, like, for example, Rohingya community and other community. It is not. But the crisis is rooted in the 1982 citizenship law and the, military government. So to address this, broader political stability in Myanmar, is very important. So without addressing the Rohingya crisis, the crisis will not end. So the exclusions of the Rohingya from the citizenship and the denial of their indigenous recognitions and the, also, barriers to participate in political, institutions. And not, accidental. They are, deliberate legal mechanism that have created the condition for systemic, violence and even genocide. So until, this legal structure reforms and Myanmar crisis will remain unsolved. The crisis will remain, unresolved. So this is the, very fundamental thing to, resolve the Rohingya crisis. For example, Rohingya, have been living in Rakhine State and other parts of Myanmar for generations. They also contributed to economic, agriculture, fishing trade and cultural life. So the historical presence is well documented in, regional histories and British colonial records. Even in contemporary scholarship, in this modern scholarship. So, different scholars, many scholars, argues about the Rohingya identity, they also develop the long-term settlements and social evolution and also the interactions with other communities in Myanmar. Also, you know, claim to the legitimate land owner, Rohingya. So, you know, the, and historically, you know, before the 1982 citizenship, the Rohingya were, you know, recognized under the 1948 Union Citizenship Act, as everyone knows, which granted them the citizenship based on birth, descent, or long-term residency. But Rohingya, you know, held citizenship card, and also they voted in national elections, and also they served as the member of parliaments and had long, you know, legal recognition Rohingya has in Myanmar. So no one can deny that the Rohingya is the core part of Myanmar, and Myanmar is part of Rohingya. So the decisive shift comes with the, you know, 1982 citizenship law, which is a discriminatory and genocidal citizenship law, as I say. So, you know, we can call the genocidal law. That law, you know, introduced the exclusionary ethnic, you know, categories and limited full citizenship right to member of the 35, you know, officially, you know, national race that are recognized. So, you know, who, you know, have, you know, presumed that to have settled in their territory before the 1823, before the colonial rule. So Rohingya were, you know, left off to this leave, you know, that effectively, you know, made an entire population stateless overnight due to 1982 citizenship law. So the exclusion was not the intentional, it was the part of the long-term political project to erase the Rohingya identity and restrict their, you know, freedoms and weaken their claim to land. So denying citizenship leave, denying the Rohingya citizenship also, you know, remove legal protections, and, you know, also they also, you know, establish the precondition for systemic persecution and mass atrocities against the Rohingya. So this is, you know, like a pre-colonial genocidal mechanism. The 1982 citizenship law is often treated as an administrative tool, and also its implications are deeper. For example, excluding population from nationality means it's deprived them of their legal identity, mobility, property, rights, education for and healthcare, and even political participation. So, and finally, justified their statelessness, which make them, you know, their populations very vulnerable, and, you know, justifies the violence against them. So these kinds of, you know, things are well documented by the different international, you know, independent organizations, international agencies like UN, you know, so these things are, you know, undeniable.
Given that your research deals with sensitive issues like identity, conflict, and human rights, have you had opportunities to engage directly with Burmese or ethnic leaders about these topics? Could you share some of your experiences from those conversations?
Yeah, whenever, you know, I meet online with Myanmar, you know, leaders and advocates, I try to share the, you know, fundamental things that are, you know, making division in Myanmar. For example, recently I also, you know, organized a social cohesion and peaceful coexistence training with the Myanmar youth and the Rohingya community youth. So, you know, also in this training, I make them understand that the Myanmar military has created division, like by, you know, disseminating wrong information and propagandas against, you know, Rohingya community and also the other, you know, minorities. So, you know, when, you know, a community has no direct interaction with another community, the misunderstanding increase. So, you know, So to remove these kinds of, you know, barrier, to remove these kinds of, you know, mistrust and misunderstanding between different communities, I organized, you know, social cohesion training and peaceful coexistence. So in this training, you know, for CIS Day, we have, you know, different kinds of dialogue, like, you know, increasing our trust and understanding each other's suffering and, you know, building trust for the future, you know, Federal Democratic Union. And, you know, when we repatriate to Myanmar, then at that time we can live side by side. We can, you know, live, you know, with one another. We can share our, you know, experiences. We can share our perspective and we can help each other. So to bring the social cohesion and peaceful coexistence, first we have, you know, share our, you know, historical sufferings, our, you know, historical misunderstanding that military has created, the, you know, military dominant, you know, the, you know, what we can call as Burmanization, like Burmese supremacy, those, you know, concept military, you know, always try to keep their powers in their hand and, you know, spread misinformations against another community, which incite violence. For example, in the 2012 violence, the military has also, you know, the military and also some, you know, ultra-nationalist Rakhines and the MOC also share different kinds of, you know, propaganda and incitement to commit violence against the Rohingya. For example, some label them as they are the security threat to our country. For example, they give lots of births, and when they give births, their population will increase and they will, you know, occupy our land. So these kinds of, you know, different kinds of, you know, propaganda, different kinds of misinformation and disinformation created the 2012 violence, and also, 2017 you know, genocidal clearance operation. The military also, you know, label the Rohingya as the security threat, and the other community will also, you know, take the word seriously. Yeah, they are security threat because they give lots of births. They are Bengali. They will, you know, destroy our country. And other community also supported, you know, coordinated with the military to commit genocide against the Rohingya. In you know, after the 2021 coup, some, you know, Myanmar people, you know, have come to understand this, and they, you know, also apologize, and they, you know, they said we were wrong, forgive us, this kinds of thing will not happen like that. But everyone has to understand the Myanmar, you know, situation, which is the, you know, which the root cause is the military. Because, for example, if we look at the, you know, 2008 constitutions, the, you know, whole power is at the hands of military. So whenever, you know, I meet the, with the Myanmar, you know, youth, with the Myanmar leaders, I, you know, try to discuss the Rohingya crisis and its, you know, root cause. And also there are lots of misunderstanding about the Rohingya, because the community is very bad. You know, they are Bengali, they do not speak the Burmese language, they are not a part of Myanmar, like that. In a country, there are, you know, different kinds of, you know, peoples. They have their own language, they have their own, you know, religions, their own culture. So it doesn't mean they are bad. Everyone should be, you know, recognized, everyone should be, treated fairly, regardless of their backgrounds, regardless of their identity, regardless of their religions. It doesn't matter. As a human, we have to respect the human dignity and the human rights. So that's the most important factor. And also, you know, we are also, you know, for example, like, how can Rohingya community can speak, you know, Burmese? Even they were not, you know, allowed to go to the school in Myanmar. Only, you know, we can say 0.5% Rohingya had the opportunity to attend a school in Myanmar. So if a community is marginalized, if a community is kept in a place where even they, you know, they cannot see the sun, will that community be able to, you know, be educated, be able to, you know, develop and understand and become civilized? So we have to understand that things. This, for 75 years, the Rohingya community have been facing, you know, violence and, you know, genocide. So will that community be developed? So those things, Myanmar people have to understand those things. We keep them, you know, under development. How can we judge them for not being speaking, you know, Burmese, for not being educated? This is the fundamental thing.
As we all know, education in Myanmar has faced many challenges for a long time, especially because of political instability and the long history of military rule. Because of this, many people, especially younger generations, may not have had the opportunity to fully understand issues such as indigenous rights, constitutional reform, or human rights violations. From my own experience, I've seen that many of my peers and friends are still trying to, you know, understand these complex issues. At the same time, it's also very difficult for people inside the country to openly discuss or engage with these topics. Personally, I believe it's very important to listen to marginalized community and, you know, create space for dialogue about peace, coexistence, and human rights. These conversations can help build greater understanding and social cohesion among different communities in Myanmar. So my question is, when you engage with leaders from different communities or regions in Myanmar, how do you usually approach those conversations, especially when discussing sensitive topics like human rights, identity, and conflict?
How do I usually, you know, engage with them? Like, for example, you know, with Zoom meetings, attending, different training with them. For example, there are, some online platform where, they teach some, different kinds of social science topics, like political science topics, like about federal democracy. When I attend, training, there are, different kinds of, engagement. There are different kinds of discussion. At that time, I also share my community experiences and my community future aspirations with them. And when, they hear directly from, me, like their lived experience person, then finally they try to understand. And also at that time, some also try to oppose that you are not, from Myanmar, you are Bengali. I also, face these kinds of issues. As you know, I'm living in Bangladesh. We cannot, meet physically. So I mostly, try to engage and communicate through internet, like from social media, like from, attending like different kinds of training, workshop.
Well, it makes sense. It's not easy to engage in person. So when you use terms like genocide or institutional reform, what responsibilities do you feel as a researcher speaking from within the community? I'm also wondering, what do international institutions often misunderstand about Rohingya-led research and advocacy?
For example, we can say, for example, National Unity Government, NUG, they, promise that they will, reform the 2008 constitution. 2008 constitution reform is okay, but without reforming the 1982 citizenship law, Rohingya, don't have the constitutional protections. For example, if a person is not the citizens of a country, they cannot be, included in the constitutional protection. So before reforming the 2008 constitution, the NUG has to reform the 1982 citizenship law. If the Rohingya become the official citizens of the Myanmar, then the constitutional, you know, right constitutional protection will work. So when I try to make them understand this, you know, concept, some, you know, understand that, yeah, as a human, we have to, you know, treat everyone equally. Everyone's citizenship should be the equal. Everyone should be, you know, the same. As I said earlier, the military replaced the 1948 Union Citizenship Act and enacted the 1982 Discriminatory Citizenship Law. You know, in 1948, you know, citizenship law, Rohingya were recognized equally as citizens of Myanmar, like other Myanmar citizens. They were, you know, recognized as the full citizens. So when the military, you know, reestablished the, you know, replaced the 1948 citizenship law, Union Citizenship Act, and enacted the 1982 citizenship law, then this law functions, work as a pre-genocidal mechanism, because it created a conditions where violence can occur without accountability, and they can do whatever they want to certain ethnic groups, the most, you know, predominantly and particularly the Rohingya. For example, the ICC, you know, in its 2022 provisional measures order, also they note that the Rohingya remain at real and imminent, you know, risk of, you know, further genocidal acts, you know, in part due to their, you know, lack of citizenship and protections. So the citizenship law systems is, that's why, more, you know, classified, and, you know, it's enable persecution and genocide against the Rohingya. After I recommend the, you know, other international, you know, government agency and other, you know, leaders, before, you know, reforming the 2008 constitution, the Myanmar, you know, leaders who are working for the federal democracy, for the, you know, democracy, try to, you know, dismantle the 2008 constitution, and provide them Rohingya equal political participation. You know, for example, if the 1982 citizenship law are not reformed, non-citizens and those without full citizenship rights are excluded from the political office, public employment, like, and constitutional protections, and even their land ownership rights. So since the Rohingya are systematically denied the citizenship, you know, they are also denied the constitutional protections. We have to understand this. Constitution grants, you know, broader power to the military. As we know, 25% of the parliament seats are reserved for the military. So, you know, and which has, you know, long played a central role in the policies targeting the Rohingya. The military authority, you know, as our security, border affairs, and also internal administrations, you know, give the military a legal means to implement discriminatory policies with impunity. So the point is that what I want to say, constitutions, you know, transform discrimination into a state legitimacy. The constitution and the citizenship law legitimize the violence and, you know, persecution against the Rohingya. You know, it's helped the military. The law held the military to exclude the Rohingya from social lives and also political life. So that is why the crisis is not, you know, we can say not, it is not, you know, unintentional. It is a intentional and it is a systematic pre-plan. The law itself works as a mechanism of repression in Myanmar. So for me, the debates, different kinds of people debates about the Rohingya identity is not a cultural, it's not a humanitarian, it is a political crisis. The very, you know, important things that Rohingya needs is recognition as an indigenous group. That matter, because if a community is recognized as an indigenous group, then it's upon that historical presence and provide, you know, legal grounding for citizenship, political rights, and cultural rights. So, for example, there are different kinds of literature, different kinds of historical records, different kinds of academic research, you know, that support the Rohingya who have settled in Rakhine State back, since 7th centuries. So, you know, like archaeological evidence, like text record, and also administrative documents, and they also oral histories. So restoring Rohingya indigenous status is the essential thing for the Rohingya community. Without any citizenship reforms, the community will also remain vulnerable to political manipulations. The political participation is equally vital. For example, if a community's members are not in higher decision making level, their community and their environment will remain under development. Including the infrastructure levels, like their education level, in all aspects. If Rohingya community cannot participate in parliament, executive, judicial, branch, our community will also remain under development. We must have the chance in the future to represent our voice equitably in the, higher level office. The Rohingya crisis is, well documented in this, modern history. Rohingya, for example, in 2015, Rohingya were stripped of their voting rights, after decades of participating in national elections. In 2015, without political representation, voting, holding office and, making laws, Rohingya, remained politically invisible because they were excluded from the voting rights. So the international community documented the crisis very well, and it's also recognized the large scales of atrocities and genocide against the Rohingya. So I can say that, in Myanmar, Rohingya crisis is the not only crisis. The crisis Myanmar faces is the multidimensional crisis. The military rules, civil wars, ethnic, insurgencies, also, international isolations and economic collapse. All these are interconnected directly or indirectly to the state treatment of the Rohingya. A state, that built on the exclusions cannot achieve national unity. So, a citizenship law and the, a citizenship law produce a statelessness cannot, produce social cohesions. A kind of tradition, for example, that institutionalized discrimination cannot promote stability in a country. So, Rohingya are parts of Myanmar, as I said earlier, and Myanmar is part of Rohingya. So excluding them damage the entire, excluding this, community mean also damaging the entire, country, whether it is visibly or invisibly, whether it is directly or indirectly. Because the country reputation in the international levels are fully damaged. The Myanmar has no, reputation internationally and regionally due to the Rohingya genocide. It is not only the after 2021 military coup. It is mainly due to the Rohingya genocide. So, I can say that Myanmar can never find peace without including the Rohingya as equal citizens with the full rights and dignity. beyond, you know, equality, equity matter a lot. Because the community that has been excluded from social and political representation for decades and putting them in the same line will not work, because they must have the equitable political participation, economical, social security, and defense representation. So without addressing the root causes of the Rohingya crisis, I can say the entire Myanmar national crisis will never be resolved and there will be no peace and stability. As far as I predict the future, as far as I, you know, according to my observation.
Well, thank you for sharing your insights and your research with us. I really appreciate the perspective you have brought to this conversation. I agree that equality and human rights are fundamental, not only in one region of the world, but globally. In Myanmar, the country has faced a long and complex history of political crisis, ethnic tensions, and misunderstandings among different communities. That's why I believe education, dialogue, and listening to one another are so important if we want to build stronger communication, collaboration, and a more peaceful future together. So my next question is this. Beyond research and teaching, daily life in the refugee camps remains very precarious. How do issues like food insecurity, fire risk, and aid dependency affect long-term planning for education and research?
Actually, in refugee city in Bangladesh, you know, humanitarian aid is very limited due to the U.S. funding cuts. For example, they provide monthly rations, like one person is like $12 per month. If a family has 8 members, they receive $8 per person. So with that $12, $12, a person cannot survive a whole month. Only $12 welfare program provide for the Rohingya for a full month. Actually, we can say with that $12, a person can survive barely for 10 days in Bangladesh. So the Rohingya refugee, purchase rice, like salt, like, onions, garlings, oils, with that $12 for a full month. And, you know, they have, no legal employment access in Bangladesh. So they cannot also work. Going outside the camps. Those who are educated, they can get a job in NGO, like with a very little salary, like 10,000 BTT, 8,000, 13,000. The highest salary is the 13,000 BTT, which is approximately $100. So those who are educated, they have little opportunity to, survive for shoppings, to buy, fish, to buy meats. Those who do not have the, educated people, who do not have someone to earn money, they are suffering a lot. They do not, buy fishes just one time in a week. They just only, eat with the, dels they receive from the World Food Program. So 90% of the family are suffering with their foods because they do not have money to buy fishes. They do not have the resources to shop, like for example, even to wear clothes. Only 10% I can see they have the normal life. And also for example, for the medical, you know, access, there are some, you know, NGO hospital, they provide some like for, if you have fever, they provide paracetamols, like that. They are not, you know, advanced treatment, just a 5-minute treatment for the, you know, fever, for the cough, and for different kinds of, you know, normal disease. For the advanced, you know, disease, the community member have to go to the, you know, private hospital, which costs, you know, huge amount of money. So many people are, you know, dying due to the lack of advanced treatment. They cannot, you know, afford the, you know, treatment cost. So overall, the situation in refugee camp is, you know, very challenging, very difficult, especially for the, you know, vulnerable people. And also, if I say about the education sector, as we discussed earlier, the NGO humanitarian education is not effective. It is mainly focused on the, you know, organizational documents to maintain their funding rather than delivering the actual education. You know, overall, the situation is very difficult for the Rohingya community refugee camps. The humanitarian assistance they receive is not even enough for half month, but they have to survive with that assistance for a full month. You can imagine with $12, how can a person survive, you know, in a month? For example, there are people who do not see meat for 1 year. They only, you know, eat meat when, you know, Eid al-Adha arrive, when, you know, a sacrificing animal festival arrive. We can call it Kurban, you know. They can only eat meat, you know, once in a year. So they are also like that people. Due to the lack of, you know, money, they cannot, you know, buy.
Well, that's really tough. That's definitely tough. Why do you think refugee camps are stay treated as, you know, temporary spaces after nearly a decade?
Yeah, actually, you know, the Bangladesh, you know, didn't sign in the 1951 Refugee Convention, and also they didn't sign in the 1967 Portugal's. So Rohingya in, you know, Bangladesh, Rohingya who are living in Bangladesh, refugee camps are not officially recognized as refugee. They are recognized as forcibly displaced Myanmar national, because the world cannot, the UNHCR and other international, you know, organization recognize Rohingya as a refugee, but the Bangladesh, you know, didn't recognize as refugee. They only see Rohingya as a displaced, you know, people. They see the, you know, with the humanitarian perspective. So the international community cannot pressure them because they didn't sign in the, you know, 1951 UN Refugee Convention, and also 1967 Portugal's. So Bangladesh has the opportunity to do whatever they want, because they are not, you know, included in the in those both treaties. So, you know, the Rohingya community do not, you know, have the access to refugee right. They are not provided refugee right. For example, if Rohingya register as refugee, they would have the chance to study, you know, at university. They have the formal, you know, officials legal permit to work. So if the community has the legal permit to work, the community wouldn't suffer that much. Now the entire community is fully dependent on the humanitarian aids, which is, you know, very, you know, frustrating. You know, the situation makes the entire community dependent. Actually, we are not the beggar. We are not the, you know, like dependent. We had our own land, we had our own property in Myanmar, we had everything. But the situation make us like a beggar, you know, fully dependent on the humanitarian aid. But we also think we are the builder. One day we'll have everything again. We'll restore our rights, we'll restore everything. We'll return to our homeland.
Well, everyone deserves a home and the opportunity to live a dignified life. No one deserves to suffer in these conditions, I believe. As we begin to wrap up our conversation, I'd like to ask about the future. You have expressed a strong commitment to constitutional and institutional reform, and you have also mentioned your interest in pursuing law school. So my question is, why law? What inspired you to choose that path?
Yeah, actually, you know, I'm interested to study law because the, you know, to understand the root causes, you know, legal education is very important. You know, for example, you know, actually to reform the citizenship law and the constitutional law, it's required the public law. But I studied by myself from different textbooks, from different, you know, online resources about the public law. So I think it is not important for me to study like at a university. So I, you know, aspire to study the international law because you know, in the Myanmar, I would like to, you know, make the build the institutions like international standard, and also, you know, like. You know, my long-term, you know, vision is to enter, you know, formal legal education and contribute to constitutional citizenship law reform in Myanmar, as I said earlier, because I want to work toward recognition of the Rohingya indigenous status as an ethnic community and the restoration of citizenship rights and democratic, you know, reforms. And the, you know, fair representations of the, you know, different marginalized groups, including the Rohingya, within the highest level of government, you know, architecture. Like I said earlier, in the legislative, executive, and judicial institutions. So not only the Rohingya, but also other ethnic community that are facing the discrimination, violence. I will also advocate for them. I will also work for them, not only about the Rohingya. Because as a human, I also see others suffering. I feel others suffering. And also, you know, I see, you know, the you know, intersections of the law, human rights, and politics, democratic, you know, governance are very related. So I want to help to dismantle, to, you know, reestablish the legal structure and political institution, you know, that enable genocide, violence, and replace them with the, you know, legal structure that's, you know, establish focus on equality, accountability, human dignity, and justice. So, as I said earlier, my, you know, childhood dream was to become a doctor. But after, you know, seeing, after researching, after, you know, observing different kinds of social contexts, like Myanmar constitution, Myanmar citizenship law, and Myanmar governmental architecture, you know, I understand more deeply, rather than becoming a doctor, I should become a change maker. I should become a legal and political scholar who can bring real impact for the entire community. If I become a doctor, for example, I can, you know, provide treatment to certain people. But if I become a change maker, you know, a peacemaker, a you know, legal and political scholar, I can, you know, bring real impact and positive differences for the entire Myanmar community. So, from the, you know, aspiring doctor, you know, I, you know, my dream, you know, transit into the aspiring legal scholar. So both forms of, you know, service, you know, the same, both are required discipline and both are rooted in the same principle that every human being desire, you know, deserve, dignity under the law and protection in practice. So, you know, I, you know, aspire to become a legal scholar to study law. For example, when I have the legal knowledge and the political knowledge, I can advocate at different international level, like engaging with different international government, different international agencies, different international organizations, and also collaborating with other Myanmar, you know, scholar, with also Myanmar leaders who have the same vision and mission, like bringing a federal democratic, like establishing federal democratic union in Myanmar. So those like-minded individuals, I will collaborate with them and work together to bring a positive change in Myanmar. I also like to work with all the Myanmar people who are struggling for the federal democracy, who are trying to establish a country with the principles of equality, justice, fairness, and the human rights. So my advocacy, my legal scholarship, and my movement will bring a positive impact, I think, in the future. I am very committed and dedicated on these things, and I hope I can bring something change in Myanmar. So for example, I don't have any opportunity right now being a refugee, but if I consider myself as a weak person, I can never achieve my dream. So whether I have the opportunity or not, I still dream big and working on it. I hope I can fulfill it one day.
Well, I really hope your vision becomes a reality one day. And I believe that together we can build a better future. So my next question is, from your perspective, what would meaningful reform actually look like?
For example, reforming the citizenship law mean like citizenship cannot be categorized into different level, like in Myanmar they are full citizenship, which are for the indigenous community, and other associate citizenship, and other one is the naturalized citizenship. So citizenship cannot be distinguished into different categories. If a person is born in Myanmar, they must have the equal citizenship. For example, if a foreigner want to become a Myanmar citizen, they should be given the, like associate or naturalized citizenship. And also, those Myanmar people who are living abroad and become the citizens of their respective country, they must have the dual citizenship in Myanmar. That is my plan. And, for example, Rohingya community were denied citizenship, they must have the full citizenship. All the peoples, all the ethnic groups, regardless of their background, their identity, their culture, their religions, everyone must have the same citizenship, what we call the full citizenship or the indigenous, citizenship. Those who are living in abroad, they must have the dual citizenship. They cannot be, the citizenship cannot be, discriminated. The citizenship cannot be, categorized based on the ethnicity, religions, culture, it should be the same. And reforming the constitution means like, the Myanmar constitution is, dominated by the military. For example, 25% of the parliament seats are reserved for the military. And, for example, including the, defense minister and, everything in every part, there is a military domination, including whether it is in legislative, the parliament, in judicial bands, for the courts and the executive bands, the cabinet division, every sectors there is the military domination. In the executive bench, the military has the power to overthrow the electric government. In times of the emergency, for example, military, in the future, constitution military don't have that right. The constitution and citizenship law should be, with the opinion of the people, with the perspective of the people, and with the power of the people. I want to, you know, create a government in Myanmar. The government should be afraid of the people, but the public, but not the public. The government should be afraid of the public. The public should, you know, shouldn't have to be afraid of the government. Currently, the publics are afraid of the government because the government is controlling the life of the public. So in the future, Myanmar government tell architecture, it should be the public who, you know, lead the government, who will instruct the government. That is my plan.
Well, I sincerely hope that Rohingya refugee communities around the world, as well as other vulnerable and marginalized communities, can one day live free from suffering and that justice will prevail. As we come to the end of our conversation, I'd like to ask a reflective question. What keeps you motivated to continue your work in research, education, and justice, despite the challenges of displacement?
Actually, the dreams are not only for myself. My dream is, you know, for my community, for my family, and for the entire Myanmar populations. So I don't see the things with my, you know, personal guns, personal, you know, against lands. I don't have any intention of the personal gain. What I want is a peaceful Myanmar country where every person, regardless of their background, have the chance to live peacefully and have the opportunity to participate in the government, whatever position they deserve with their, you know, quality. So it is a dream for every Myanmar people. It is a dream for the Rohingya community. It is a dream for my family. And even it is a, you know, dream for the entire world. And I think it will be an example and the inspirational, you know, things for the global young people.
That's truly inspiring. Thank you so much for sharing your vision and your dreams with us. It's really powerful. As a final question, what message would you like young Rohingya students who are listening to this podcast to hear?
Yeah, actually, I would like to say to them, seek knowledge and stay committed and learn whatever resources you have and wherever you are. Do not, you know, give up your dreams. Keep focused on your dreams and also work for your community, for your country, and try to collaborate with other Myanmar peoples and share your feeling with them and understand each other's suffering and try to bring positive change and establish a cohesive and peaceful society rather than, you know, creating divisions. So I would also like to say other Myanmar, you know, young people, please never try to spread misinformation and disinformation. Try to understand each other and hope for a better future in Myanmar. So, everyone try to, you know, dream for a federal, inclusive, democratic country where all ethnic groups, including the Rohingya, have the political representation, citizenship, and recognition in Myanmar.
Yes, absolutely. We need more ambition and we need people like you, other leaders and the younger generation to speak out and stand up for their identity and their communities. That's incredibly important. And your message is truly powerful and inspiring. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights with us.
You are most welcome. Thank you very much for having me today. Actually, I'm very happy that I feel today my voice is also heard. So I'm very, you know, grateful and thankful for having me today.
Well, as a final question, what is one common misconception about Rohingya people, academically or politically, that you would like to challenge?
Yeah, those, you know, who, there are also some people who might not agree with my, you know, perspective, with my opinion. But, you know, they have to understand that, you know, without peaceful coexistence, without social cohesion, there will be no peace in Myanmar. For example, Rohingya, you know, repatriated to Myanmar and they become, the Myanmar become very peaceful and even democratic. If Rohingya community are not, you know, united with other community, if they do not have the communication, if they do not have the better relationship, there will also be misunderstanding and there will not be peace. So to establish peace and, you know, social cohesion and peaceful coexistence in Myanmar, every community should have the interaction, should have the communication, should have the better relationship to understand each other, to share, you know, each other's experiences.
Well, Mohammed, thank you so much for sharing your insight, leadership, and vision with us today.
You are most welcome.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. The stories and conversations we share are meant to inform, inspire, and deepen our understanding of the rich tapestry of experiences that can be found in Myanmar. And as you might imagine, producing this podcast requires a great deal of time, effort, and resources. So if you've gained some value from what you've just heard, we ask you to consider paying it forward. Your support can continue to ensure that we're able to produce and share more episodes like the one you just heard. Every donation directly fuels our ability to reach out to a more diverse range of guests, record their powerful stories, and bring them to life for listeners around the world. So by contributing, you're not just supporting this podcast, you're also creating opportunities for others to benefit from and hearing these conversations down the road. So if you believe in the work we're doing and want to see it continue, please visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Together, let's keep this conversation going. Yarananga yaunya na dadu ya dana biari ganeza de mana we gara besa yana besa yo ho ba yarananda da yarananga na yarananya da yarananga poda ba yarananga.